Well, we hope you're in for the door prize. We'll be giving a copy of Tom's book away tonight, so compliments of the University Press of Kentucky. Well, good evening and welcome to the fourth presentation in this our 13th season of talks on Kentucky Live, Southern Culture at its Best, sponsored by the Friends of WKU Libraries. My name is Brian Coots, and as head of the Department of Library Public Services, I coordinate this series with help from our webmaster taking pictures back there, Haiwan Wan, and our research instruction coordinator at the back, Brian Carson. Ryan Dowell and Patrick Peters designed our posters, and our technical specialist tonight is Daniel Pollitt. Our speaker tonight is a New York native whose family is spread around the world, he says. And growing up, he wanted to be a musician and scientist and was influenced by his mother, a science editor, and his father, who was a musician. He attended schools in Baltimore before enrolling in the State University of New York College of Environmental Science and Forestry, receiving his BS in Forest Biology in 1975. After working for a couple of years as a research biologist, he enrolled in a graduate program of forestry and botany at the University of Wisconsin and received a PhD in 1982. Since then, he's conducted research on tree physiology and biochemistry here and tree physiology and urban forestry abroad, and is the author of more than 40 research papers. He's taught at universities in Malaysia and Indonesia, and in 1982 joined the faculty of the University of Kentucky in the Department of Forestry, the graduate program in plant physiology and biochemistry, and the natural resources and environmental science program. From 2001 till 2014, he served as a consultant in forest management, biomass, renewable energy, and urban forestry. In 2014, he founded Venerable Trees Incorporated, a nonprofit dedicated to the conservation of woodland pastures and ancient trees in the bluegrass. His first book, Venerable Trees, History, Biology, and Conservation in the Bluegrass, was recently published by the University Press of Kentucky and is the theme of tonight's talk. His newest book, The Lives of Trees, is due out later this year. When not teaching or researching, he enjoys photography, hiking, playing the violin, and spending time with his kids. Please welcome Tom Kimmerer. Tom?
Thank you very much. Well, good evening, and thanks for inviting me here. We had a very pleasant dinner across the street, and it's nice to see you all. I'm going to talk about the rarest ecosystem in North America. I'm going to explain in a minute what I mean by that. I'm also going to talk a little bit more than I usually do about the science behind what I do, for two reasons. One, I was invited here by a research institution, so it seemed appropriate to talk about research. But also, this is a phenomenally important day in the history of science. Does anybody know what happened today? Gravity. Announcement of the discovery of gravitational waves. One of the most stunning discoveries ever made. Albert Einstein published a paper 100 years ago this year predicting the existence of gravitational waves, and it's taken that long until today to prove that they exist. So I'll talk a little bit more than I usually do about the science. So I live in central Kentucky in the bluegrass, and if you live in the bluegrass, you're used to the habitat looking like it does in this picture. That is, rolling green hills, horses, black or white fences, but also an incredible number of really old trees. And I'll talk about what I mean by really old in a minute. So everywhere you go in the bluegrass, and I'll define what the bluegrass is in just a minute, you see these gigantic ancient trees. And I've lived in the bluegrass for about almost 35 years, and I've watched these trees, and I've watched them disappear, and I've always been puzzled by them because nobody had ever really written anything about them, done any research about them. So a few years ago, I decided that I really needed to understand this rare and unusual ecosystem. Lucy Brown, the famous forest ecologist, referred to the vegetation of the bluegrass in the Nashville Basin as the most anomalous vegetation in North America. She didn't understand it. And now, because of the research I've done that went into the book, we pretty much understand it. And I should tell you, if you're a science phobe, even though it's a science book, it's pretty light on the science. I'm going to start this story by talking about how Kentucky developed, where it came from.
So this is the headwater of South Elkhorn Creek, and we're actually going to be returning to this habitat several times. The Elkhorn is a tributary of the Kentucky, so it flows downstream into the Kentucky River, which eventually winds up in the Ohio. This is the Filson map of Kentucky, published in 1784. It's the first accurate map of Kentucky, and it actually is remarkably accurate up to about here, and then he's got the Ohio River going too far south. But it was a pretty accurate map, and what I've done is stretched it to overlay a modern digital map of the state. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to zoom in here and see if we can understand something about this rare and strange habitat. So here's the Kentucky River. Here's the Elkhorn Creek that I just showed you pictures of. And so the first settlers came up the Kentucky, and then they walked up. Elkhorn's not navigable. They walked up along the Elkhorn, and they came through the area known as the Hills of Bluegrass and then into the inner Bluegrass. And as they came up, they told stories. I went to the University of Wisconsin and read the original manuscripts of all the oral narratives that have been collected over the years. And what I found was that every settler's story about what they saw was different. Some people said, we went through dense forest. Other people said, there was grass and tall cane. Other people said, there was grass and tall cane and big open grown trees. And that's puzzling until you realize that these people were on foot. And you can imagine going to some dense area and hiking, that two of you take two different routes, you may have very different experiences. So what happened was, these people were walking through a mosaic landscape, one that varied spatially a lot. And so their experience was conditioned by exactly what direction they went. Notice it says fine cane here, one of the dominant vegetation types of the region, and in fact of all of the southeastern United States, was cane, which is our bamboo, Rondinaria gigantea. Some of these cane stands were so large and so dense that people got lost in them. Josiah Collins, who built the first building ever built in Lexington, was walking down a buffalo trace with a friend, and they thought they heard some Indians. There weren't any, but they ducked off into the cane to hide, and they came out of the cane 3 days later, 38 miles away. So there was a lot of cane, but there was also this strange habitat of open grown trees shading grass of cane. So I spent the better part of a year trying to figure out what the landscape looked like in 1779, which is when Lexington was settled. And this is my model of what it looked like. So they're coming up the Elkhorn, and you have, in orange, you have these dense stands of cane along the creeks. And cane could be 30 feet tall. We don't find cane stands that tall anymore. Other areas, there was forest. Other areas, there was a mixture of grass and cane in open-grown areas. And then, the brown stipples showing this woodland pasture habitat. And that's what the first settlers called it. They called it woodland pasture. Now, where else does this occur? There's only two places in North America that have woodland pasture, and that is in the Bluegrass and in the Nashville Basin. And if you know your geology, you know that that's the same rock. The Cincinnati Arch forms the Lexington limestone, 6,000 feet thick limestone bed in the Bluegrass, and that same rock comes back up again in the Nashville Basin. The kind of reddish-brown shows the original range of the American bison. A lot of people don't realize that bison was an eastern animal. And then the blue line shows the approximate original range of giant cane. And these all play into our story. So let me show you a little bit about what woodland pastures look like. So you can wander around any place in central Kentucky in the Bluegrass, and you'll find this on all the farms. So what you find is, you find a farm with gigantic old trees that in all cases vastly predate the age of the farm. And this is one of the things that makes Bluegrass very unusual is, you know, if you see a house with great big trees, oh, they must have planted lots of trees after they built the house. In Kentucky, they did it the other way around. They found a grove of nice trees and put a house in the middle. So in all cases, the trees vastly predate the houses. This is a horse farm with a bur oak. This bur oak and two others in the bluegrass take turns being the largest known in the world, depending on how well they're growing. Here's a fairly typical farm scene in the bluegrass. Another very typical farm scene. Now, what happened when the settlers arrived here is that they found these open-grown trees shading grass and cane, and in order to farm it, they didn't have to do anything. They had to chase the indigenous animals away, which I'll show you in a minute, put up some fences, move their cattle and sheep in, and horses came later, and they could farm it without having to fell the trees. One little piece of trivia for you. Lexington is the only 18th century city on this side of the mountains that is not on a navigable river. Only one. Because in the 18th century, how did you get around? You got around by water. Okay. There's no navigable river in central Kentucky, but people settled here because they found these open-grown habitats. They didn't have to clear the land. If you arrived in Bowling Green, or you arrived in Pittsburgh, or you arrived in these other places where they developed cities, those were all heavily forested areas where they had a river. So they had to clear the forest in order to be able to move in. We didn't have to do that in this case. So these trees, as individuals, are the same trees that were here 300 years ago, and sometimes 500 years ago. We see the same habitat in the Nashville Basin, much less of it, and if you want to ask me about that at the end, I can explain why. I think it is. Now, as the urban area of Lexington and Louisville developed, Louisville's also in this region, a lot of these woodland pastures were lost, except in parks and other open areas, and sometimes just in people's yards, where individual trees, I call them left-behinds, were left. So you'll appreciate this as an arborist. We have several thousand trees in the Lexington urban area that are over 300 years old. This is a public park with an ancient blue ash tree. We don't find many cities with that. Here's an elementary school with an ancient bur oak. Here's a waste industrial area with a great big huge bur oak. Here's a hospital with a parking lot. They were going to cut the tree down to build the parking lot. The neighbors got so much up in arms that they actually built the parking lot around the tree. This is a kind of a prized tree. There's a housing development going in back there, and there was a huge amount of uproar about this tree. All the neighbors came out and said, you can't cut it down. I said that this is the most popular tree in the city because it's been in the local newspaper 15 times, and I'm kind of responsible for that tree now. Well, what trees am I talking about? I'm not talking about a random collection of trees. I'm talking about a specific set of five tree species, and those are bur oak, which most of you know, Shumard oak, which is a southern tree, Chinkapin oak, blue ash, which will not be familiar to you here because there is no blue ash right around here, but in the bluegrass in the Nashville Basin, it's our most abundant ash tree, very long lived. And then kingnut, which is also called shellbark hickory. Kingnut is the original name, by the way, and I'm persuading people to revert to that. It's called kingnut because the fruit is the size of a tennis ball, and it was enormously important as a food source for livestock and people. And I think we ought to persuade the students to go back to the original name. Now, what these trees have in common, these five species, is that they are immensely long-lived, immensely drought-tolerant, and relatively slow-growing. Now, there were certainly other trees present. There was black locust and honey locust and sugar maple and lots of other species. But these are the ones that we know live long enough that the same individuals are here today. So we, for example, have lots of black locust in the bluegrass, but those are not the same trees that were here. Those are the descendants of the trees that were here originally. Sometimes people call this savanna, and that's a mistake. This is a savanna. This is an oak savanna in Wisconsin, and my classmates and I used to make pocket change burning savannas. Lots of fun. There is no evidence that fire ever played a role in the bluegrass trees. So we don't call them savannas. We call them woodland pastures. Now, I said this is the rarest ecosystem in North America. It occurs in the Nashville Basin and the bluegrass. But it does occur other places in the world. There are large woodland pastures throughout Europe. This is southern Romania, Transylvania region. This is northern England. This is actually part of the Royal Grounds in northern England. This is Russia outside of Moscow. And the reason this is important, this has informed a lot of my research that went into this book. The reason this is important is that there's been a lot more research done on these. And we know that these were created in the same fashion that our woodland pastures were created, which I'm going to tell you about in a minute. So here's what we have today. We have these farms of livestock, cattle and horses, the sheep are largely gone because of foot rot. And these beautiful old houses and these beautiful farms, and in all cases we have these trees that greatly predate the existence of the farms. How did this happen? How did this come to be? Well, there's several factors. First of all, here's the bluegrass, here's the Nashville Basin, you are here. The first thing is geology. The blue is carbonate karst. Karst rock, as many of you know, limestone rock, is water soluble. So as the rain comes down, it dissolves the rock and you get fissures and cracks and crevices and caves. Mammoth Cave is a karst cave. And so the result of that is that you get very droughty soils. We have these deep, very rich soils, and yet 2 days after it rains, all the creeks are dry because of this karst rapid drainage. So drought is a big factor in karst. Well, speaking of drought, this is the drought index, the Palmer Drought Index. Trees are very sensitive to drought. And so here's a drought index that starts in the year 500 and goes up to approximately now. And we've had some incredibly profound droughts in this region. When I say this region, this applies probably not just to the bluegrass, but probably to a region that includes here. We had a drought that lasted from about the year 635 to the year 1000. We had multi-decade droughts shown by the red bands here. And the reason that's important is that most of our old trees got established either during or right after the severe droughts. So we think drought is a major driving factor in helping these trees get established. And if you're sitting there wondering, how does he know what the drought index was like in the year 635, think about it and ask during the question period. Here is the key species. You know, we talk in ecology, we talk about keystone species, that is, individual species that are tremendously important in shaping a habitat. The American bison was extremely abundant in the bluegrass. We know that there were hundreds of thousands of bison. We know that they were the dominant animal on the landscape. We know that that was not true elsewhere. That is, they weren't all throughout the entire East. But here's a couple of important things to know about bison. When you look at bison out on a field like this, they look very placid and very calm. In fact, they're incredibly athletic animals. They will wander 25 miles in a night. They will move 200 to 300 miles in a season. And they are strictly grazers, they're not browsers. They don't eat woody plants, they don't eat grass and cane. So here's what happened. Bison, this herd of bison would come in and graze an area. And then they would leave. They would leave either to get better grazing or, because of our droughty streams, they would leave to go to permanent water, better water. And also the bluegrass and the Nashville Basin both are surrounded by salt licks. And so the bison would leave and go to salt licks. And we know there are salt licks in Kentucky. Blue Lick State Park is a famous one, where the ground has just been churned up by generations of bison. So imagine this, huge herd of bison. They graze all the grass down, and then they leave for 10 or 20 or 30 years. And that gave time for the woody plants to get established. By the time the bison came back, they were big enough that they didn't all get destroyed. Now, if you're used to looking at bison like this, you may not understand what I mean when I say they're immensely athletic animals. So I want to show you my friends at North Star Bison made this. And yes, bison sound like this. Now this is absolutely normal. They race around, they goof off. Throw some pouring over the hill. If you have teenage boys, you'll recognize this one right here. Now, I want you to especially watch towards the end as they come pouring over this hill. You know, basically a river of 1,000-pound animals. Features. The way they come pouring over the hill in vast herds, and this is just a little farm herd. Now, multiply this by 1,000 or 500 at least. Imagine that you're a Native American and you don't have a horse or a rifle. You're not going to have a village here. Well, guess what? It turns out that there are no Native American village remains, evidence, in the inner area. None at all. One settler, early settler, came and built a cabin and a stockade and a garden and moved his family in. And then he had to go back east to vote in the Virginia House of Delegates. And while he was gone, the bison returned. And when he returned to his home, fortunately his family had gotten out. His entire farm had been turned to dust. The cabin, the stockade, the garden, everything. So you can imagine the difficulty of life in the presence of these animals. The Indians would hunt in the winter. The bison would go up along the Ohio and Licking and Salt Rivers in the winter to have access to water. So they would basically leave during the winter. And that's when the Indians would hunt. And even the long hunters, the early hunters, pioneer hunters that came in, would only hunt in the winter. Now, this is the key to understanding this ecosystem, this immense animal that churns up the soil, chows down the grass, chows down the cane, and then leaves for 20 years. Perfect conditions for trees to come in. And that's what happened. So the woodland pasture habitat was here before the settlers came. All they had to do to farm here was get rid of the bison. By 1805, there were no bison left, because they had rifles. Here's a 1904 picture of a woodland pasture. Looks pretty much like it did at the time it was settled, and importantly, it looks pretty much like it did today. Okay, so you have horses grazing. The farmers had no incentive to cut trees down. In fact, they had an incentive to keep them, which is to reduce heat stress on their livestock. One of the things you'll notice, though, is lots of fairly tall vegetation. And we do know that as late as the early 1900s, these trees were still reproducing. They're not today. Now, I'm going to show you the exact same woodland pasture. I found it. See that tree? That's that tree. Okay, this is the same woodland pasture. These are the same trees. Okay, but what's different is the ground cover. You notice the ground cover now is all grass, and it's been mowed. And so the difference between this and this is not the presence of livestock, it's the invention of a gasoline-powered tractor and the ability to mow. Before this, they didn't mow, they just grazed it. And as a result of that, our woodland pasture trees are no longer reproducing. So now we have the situation that would be familiar to anybody who thinks of any population, death is greater than birth. You can talk about trees, or you can talk about Japan. So we have trees that get old and die for various reasons, which we'll talk about in a minute. And we have almost no natural regeneration. It's extremely hard to find seedlings of these trees because we're grazing and mowing wall to wall. The horses and the cattle are not leaving for a decade. And the conditions for reproduction are very poor. So why do they die? The primary reason is development. That's pretty obvious. Second one is mower damage. Poor soil management. Lightning is very important. This is a lightning kill trees. Oak trees in England, woodland pastures, live about twice or 2.5 times as long as oak trees in woodland pastures in Kentucky. And I puzzled over that for a long time until I realized that we get 50 times the frequency of lightning strikes in the summer as England. So that's important. Old age is obviously one. Now, interestingly enough, pests and pathogens is not a big issue. We don't have any major pests and pathogens that beset these trees. Now, what about birth? As I said, we're continuously grazing, we're constantly mowing, we're compacting the bejesus out of our soils. Development's obviously a big issue, but lack of understanding and lack of effort is a big one. The horse farms plant a lot of trees. They just plant the wrong species. They're replacing 300 to 500 year old trees with trees that might live 50 years, like dead maple, which in my opinion is a disease, not a tree. We need to understand something about trees to be able to appreciate these trees, and that is, we're used to thinking of a nice looking tree as, you know, this big tall thing with a great big crown looking all pretty, no dead branches, you know, none of that nasty stuff. Old trees look like hell, okay? They look like this. This is a fantastic tree. It's lost its top to lightning. The whole backside of it is dead, okay? And yet, see that? This tree is growing at a phenomenal rate. One of the things that scientists have learned just in the last 2 years is something very interesting about the behavior of trees, about the biology of trees. We thought for a long time, maybe because we make analogies to humans, that as trees get old, you know, as trees get older, they start to grow, and they grow faster and faster and faster, and they get older, and they slow down, right? Turns out that the older the tree is, the faster it grows. We just don't notice it because its volume is so big that if it's adding, you know, a tree this big that's adding the same amount of wood as a tree this big, you're not going to notice. So trees grow faster as they grow older. They store more carbon than younger trees, faster. And they do things like this. This tree is perfectly healthy. There's nothing wrong with this tree. Now, from an arborist standpoint, if this were in a park or a playground, you might say, oh, this tree might be risky. But this tree, if it falls, is not going to hurt anybody. And the growth rates in these trees are just phenomenal. This, by the way, is also an example of something extremely rare that I've only seen twice in Burr Oak. This is a phoenix tree. What's happened is this branch is the main branch of the tree now. You can see almost everything living on this tree is on this branch, right? And it got way down and it touched the ground. Guess what? It rooted. There are roots underneath here. We took an air knife and dug it up. And so this is actually a different tree than that. It's a clone of it. And eventually, if this tree dies, this one will probably keep going. That's very rare. Part of our problem in appreciating and understanding really old trees is that we live in a different time scale. We need to learn to live in tree time. I guess I sort of live in tree time. That won't happen for another 100 years. I don't need to worry about it. But so we're these funny little scurrying around, short-term things. Here's a tree in a park, lost its crown, is completely hollow. Children climb up in this thing. Lost most of the tissue on that side. And yet you look at the crown that it's rebuilt, and it's fantastic. It's a healthy, fast-growing tree. In addition, this tree is not a significant risk because if it falls down, it's going to fall down in a storm, and those little scurrying around people are not going to be there in a storm. So it's not a risky tree. So we need to appreciate the difference between really old trees and the trees we're sort of used to thinking of. Now, here's a Burr Oak that's about 70 inches in diameter. And you look at this crown, you say, this is a magnificent, this is like a specimen tree, right? This is the top of that tree. This tree is a third the height that it used to be. And this is perfectly normal. Trees do not get taller, old trees do not get taller as they get older. They get shorter and broader, and they stay healthy. Now we come to the nut of the matter, which is we have a serious conservation issue. The trees are not reproducing, and we're going to lose them. So we have to make a decision whether we want our future landscape to look like this or this. And without our efforts, woodland pastures will disappear. We need to be planting trees. We need to be creating conditions in which they can reproduce themselves. We need to be taking care of the trees that we have. I've been on so many farms where the trees are just constantly being bashed by bush hogs, and that's going to shorten their lives. Now, do you guys know this book, The Martian? Great movie, okay? Important in that the protagonist is, of course, a botanist. So Mark Watney said, I'm going to have to science the shit out of this. So that's what we're doing now. We're starting to science the shit out of woodland pastures and trying to understand how to manage them and how to grow them. I told you that these are the focus of a lot more effort and interest in Europe. And throughout Europe, there are groups of scientists and other people who are working to understand the woodland pasture habitat, which, by the way, was created by wisent, which is European bison. It's thousands of years old. But you have these groups of scientists, and you have groups of very important people that are getting together to say, how do we preserve this pasture? This is my friend Tibor Hartel. He and I work together every day. We get on Facebook in the morning when he's having his first beer of the late afternoon, and I'm having my coffee. And we talk about the research we're doing. We're writing a paper together. This is one of his field assistants, who you might recognize as the next King of England. Prince Charles has taken an intense personal interest in the woodland pasture habitat. He's actually been buying woodland pastures in Romania to conserve them. And so they're getting a lot more attention in Europe than they are here. And in fact, if you looked at a stack of research papers on woodland pastures in Europe, they look like this. And here they look like this, if you're generous. And my book is actually the first extensive treatise to talk about this. Let me see where I am here. Yeah. So, speaking of research, this, I'm so excited about this. I couldn't not talk about this. This has not been published yet. We only discovered this last week. I've been working on a project on a big farm in Jessamine County that has a very extensive woodland pasture. It has all the woodland pasture species. It's a very old farm. It has a house with it making 23. It's on the headwaters of the South Elkhorn Creek. And it has this gorgeous woodland pasture and this hill slope that leads up like this. So here's the same tree. And we noticed that this slope was very interesting because there are no trees on this part of the slope. But I started doing some soil sampling back here in the woodland pasture and out here. And you know what I discovered? The soil's never been plowed. It's never been disturbed. It's a virgin soil. It's a completely undisturbed soil. Well, the state of Kentucky, in its infinite wisdom, has decided to widen the road that's right off on the left there. So they had to hire archaeologists to come and inspect the site. I thought that was great because we got some free archaeology done. So we dug soil pits. Okay. Now, if you know soils and you look carefully at this, you can very clearly see that this is a completely untouched soil. Now think about that. That means the soil has not only not been touched since settlement, but we had no glaciers. So how old is this soil? No idea. Last week, we found this. This looks like, to me, not being an archaeologist, this looks like somebody made it yesterday. This point was 5 centimeters down in this soil, and it's at least 3,000 years old. 3,000 years old. So that confirms what we thought, that this is an ancient, ancient habitat. How far back further does it go? We have no idea. We probably will never know. Although there's a group of paleoecologists, which are not old ecologists of old things, who are going to come down next summer and help us figure it out. So this habitat not only goes back pre-settlement, as I told you before, but goes back thousands of years. This is completely undisturbed. This looks probably exactly as it did thousands of years ago. What a treasure. Now, the other thing that we're starting to do research on that I think is going to be really important in the long run is carbon sequestration. As we start to address climate change, and I think in spite of yesterday's Supreme Court decision, I think we will start to address it. At some point, we're going to put a price on carbon. And that means that people who can store carbon are going to get financial benefits for doing that. Okay, it's already happening in Europe. It's beginning to happen here. So now what we have is we have a deep ancient soil that's very high in organic matter, so it stores a lot of carbon. And we also have these great big trees that store a lot of carbon. And here's what I think. I don't know this yet. I'll tell you in a couple of years from now. But we know now that forests store most of their carbon in the biggest trees. That is, a forest stand stores more than 70% of its carbon in the 20% largest trees. So if you think about that, that meant if you went into a forest and took out all the small trees, you wouldn't be taking out that much carbon. But you might create something that looks like this. In other words, this woodland pasture, taking into account the carbon above ground and the carbon in the soil, may store as much carbon as a forest. So these are research areas that we're just getting going on. I mean, this is straight out of the field. We dug this up literally last week. So there's some great research opportunities here. Now, I want to talk about where we are. Okay, because here's the bluegrass, and here's the Nashville Basin. And we know that the woodland pastures are abundant and common here. There are woodland pastures in the Nashville Basin, far fewer than there are here. I believe that's a consequence of losing the war, which you imagine by human truth. But here we are. Now, this is the bedrock geology, surface geology. We have limestone here, sedimentary rock here. Okay? But that sediment is sitting on top of limestone. So if you look at the karst map, you know, those highly drained soil, you see karst here, you see karst here, but we also see karst through here. So it occurs to me that some of these same trees, and possibly even some woodland pastures, may occur. It's hard for me to imagine that the woodland pastures went, oh, no, we're not going to grow north of here. No, we're not going to grow south of here. Now, we don't have blue ash here, to my knowledge. Is that correct? Yeah, I looked at the range maps. Do you know,
Jared? You know, one or two here and there, but they're not predominant.
Okay, so it's the one or two here and there that's really of interest to me because, and this is the land use pattern. You'll notice that our land use in the bluegrass is predominantly pasture in yellow, and the same thing in the International Basin. West of here, you have mostly cropland, but you have a lot of pasture land in here. So here's what I want to give you an assignment to do. As you travel around in this region, pay attention to big trees. I came down here today on the blue highways. I didn't take the interstate. I saw a lot of big trees. I didn't take the time to stop and really look at them in detail. I'd be very interested in knowing whether we have large bur oaks, large chinquapin oaks, and large kingnuts, and large shumard oaks in this region, suggesting that at one time there might have been a continuum of the woodland pasture habitat. You see how close they are, only a few counties apart. So that's your homework assignment. And I actually have a sign-up sheet. We like to stay in touch with people that we meet, so I have a sheet that I'd like you to give me your name and email address. We'll send you a newsletter, and if you don't like it, you just tell us you don't want it anymore. But we'd be very interested in hearing from folks who find any of these trees. You can go on our website, venerabletrees.org. Learn more about how to identify these trees. Now, what I haven't said is, why do I call them venerable trees? I don't call them pre-settlement trees or ancient trees or anything else. So let me read the introduction of my book. It's called Two Trees. Two trees stand on opposite sides of the earth. One is a Bodhi tree near the grave of the royal family in the Karo Highlands of Sumatra. The tree is guarded by, or perhaps is guarding, two stone men covered in moss and lichen that nearly blend into the tree. The other tree is an old bur oak shading a grave in the bluegrass of Kentucky. The headstone is eroded with age and, like the stone men, is draped in moss and lichen. Both trees are ancient, with the stout cylindrical stems and coarse branching of very old trees. People in all cultures revere large old trees, from temple trees in Southeast Asia to the giant sequoia and coastal redwood groves of the American West. People visit, worship, and love trees. Trees are venerated, held in awe and esteem. Our relationship with trees is both practical and reverential. We can easily appreciate a large old oak tree while comfortably dining at a beautiful oak table. We've always used trees for food, fiber, fuel, and shade, but our relationship with trees also has a deep spiritual context that dates back to the time before we were even human. Our ancestors were arboreal creatures living in and among trees. When we left the forest, we did not leave the trees behind. Most of the world's population is now urban, yet even in cities we surround ourselves with trees. Urban trees have practical utility, cooling buildings and sidewalks, cleaning the air, providing shade. But it is the spiritual connection we maintain with trees that compelled us to bring them along when we left our ancestral forests.
This book is a celebration of the long relationship between people and trees, and a cautionary tale of what happens when we neglect that relationship. I will focus on very old trees in two closely related urban and agricultural areas, the Bluegrass of Kentucky and the Nashville Basin. Most of these trees were present before the first permanent settlement in the late 1700s and remain with us today, but they are disappearing and not being replaced. I will refer to these as venerable trees to indicate their great age and value, though with only a few exceptions, their exact ages are unknown. My first venerable tree, the first one that I spent time with and cared about, was an old American beech rotten at its base, offering plenty of room for a fort, cave, or superhero's lair. My beech was a treasure trove for boys and girls in my Baltimore neighborhood. Fungi popped from its bark or roots in spring and fall, and insects, fence lizards, snakes, and raccoons wandered in and out of the crevices in the rotting stem. We relished the sweet, crunchy beech nuts in the fall and enjoyed the work of extracting them from their shells. There were oaks, maples, plenty of trees whose names I did not know until a decade later. But it was the beech that was the center of our woodland play, and the beech that I remember individually among all the trees of my childhood. Eventually it died and fell, but I can still find traces of the old tree as an umber stripe of decayed wood under leaf litter. Years later, I became a forest scientist and have spent many years devoted to the practical utility of trees, but I never completely lost the reverence for that old beech and all the subsequent trees in my life. In 1982, I came to Kentucky and soon moved with my family to a small farm in Garrett County, 30 miles south of Lexington. Each day on my commute, I would see giant trees on farms, in abandoned pastures, and in industrial areas. Many of them had the dead tops or stag heads that indicate great age, decline, lightning strikes, or all three. The oldest trees that I saw were bur oak, blue ash, Schumard oak, chinkapin oak, and kingnut, and I began thinking of them as the venerable trees of the bluegrass. I began keeping track of all the venerable trees I saw. Over the ensuing years, many of these trees had become very familiar to me, and I watched them change over the seasons and years. Some have died catastrophic deaths taken by lightning or bulldozers. Others died more slowly for more subtle reasons, and some of these remained standing for decades after their deaths. Still others, but ever fewer, remain hale and hearty, shading horse pastures and gas stations alike. I have also sought out young trees of these venerable species, usually in vain. One day in the late 1980s, while scouting locations for teaching field classes, I chanced upon an elderly blue ash on the edge of a field. When I walked out into the field to see this giant, I realized that the hedgerow I was walking along had blue ash saplings and seedlings in abundance. There were hundreds of young blue ash trees, all apparently the progeny of the huge mother tree. I paid scant attention to the signs of impending doom, the survey stakes, the distant bulldozer. A few days later, I brought my class to the site. The mother tree remained, but all her progeny had been bulldozed into piles, slowly burning in the morning breeze. A sign indicated a new housing development, Ashbrook. Even the venerable mother tree is gone now, having succumbed to soil compaction and the insults of suburban lawn care. We badly need vigorous efforts to extend the lifetime of our ancient trees through better public engagement, better management, and better policies. We also need to plant more of the most characteristic native species from local seed sources and manage them properly. We need to take action to ensure that the venerable trees of our current landscape are sustained through all the generations to come. Beyond these practical considerations, we must be more mindful of the presence of venerable trees in our midst. We may travel thousands of miles to see famous old trees like the redwoods, while ignoring trees equally worthy of our veneration in the landscapes in which we live. I wrote this book not to recount how much we know about these trees, their management, and their future, but to remind us how little we know. The more people become aware of the ancient trees in our landscapes, the more we will be stimulated to see them clearly, tend them carefully, conserve them vigorously, and try to understand them fully. Most important of all is my hope that more of us will venerate these trees enough to ensure their future. Thank you.
And we have time for questions. You mentioned you had done some research in the Belle Meade region of Nashville. You might talk a bit about that.
Yeah, the Nashville is, there's a lot of venerable trees in Nashville. Most of them are individual. They are concentrated in the area from approximately Belle Meade south, and approximately in between the Warner Parks and Radnor Lake, if you know that area. There are fewer of them in the inner Nashville Basin. I've puzzled over this for a long time, and I think the answer, and I said this jokingly previously, but I think it's true. At the end of the Civil War, the South was thrown into a depression. The slaves were freed. The big plantations couldn't be managed anymore. Much of the land was abandoned. But farmers, both the freed slaves and the original plantation owners, began farming much more intensively. They had to, because of poverty. And so they cleared the trees. I believe that's what happened. Whereas Lexington, you know, Kentucky was a northern state in the Civil War. Yeah, we were somewhat divided, but we stayed with the North. And one of the things I've found in talking to some economists is that Kentucky went into a boom after the Civil War. Okay, so we had, on the one hand, Tennessee suffering from a severe depression and Kentucky prospering. And the horse industry really took off. And they had a built-in incentive to preserve those trees. I think that's the predominant reason. And yet, now, part of the issue here is I've spent a lot more time in the Bluegrass than I have in the Nashville Basin. My family goes to Nashville every summer. But part of it is maybe we just haven't found the really good ones. I gave a talk to the Sierra Club in Nashville a few weeks ago with a big turnout. And just before, it was at Radnor Lake, just before I went driving around the area, and I found two big woodland pastures that I hadn't seen before. So they're probably more than we think. And the Sierra Club in the Nashville Basin is undertaking a project to survey for more. But yeah, that's the difference. Now, I should say, inner Nashville Basin soils are also a lot thinner than bluegrass soils. So that may play a role. Yes, sir?
Are there any other species in those pastures, or would be in those pastures, that affect the trees, whether they're
remaining
or the
dynamic? Yeah, there's... If you look at the list of trees that were in the original woodland pastures that the early settlers listed, you know, there were probably 40 species that they commonly said, you know, black locust, honey locust, sugar maple, mulberry, lots of other things. What I said at the beginning is the difference between those trees and these five species is these five species live long enough that the same individuals are here. So, those other trees are still there. And some of them actually, especially black walnut and hackberry, are reproducing fine by themselves because they do well along hedgerows, etc. One puzzling tree was sugar maple. Sugar maple was abundant in the bluegrass. Sugar maple and its close relative black maple were abundant in these woodland pastures. They were large trees. We know they were here. That's one of the reasons we know fire did not play a role, because sugar maples are very sensitive to fire. And yet we don't find any great big old sugar maples. And it took a long time to realize this. My first wife, Robin Kimmerer, is a renowned Native American ethnobotanist and author of several really good books. She explained it to me. When settlers arrived in the eastern United States, especially in the Northeast, there were Native Americans there to teach them how to grow corn, how to grow squash, and how to tap maple trees by making a rod, a hollow rod, and tapping it into the tree. Remember I said there were no permanent Native American populations here? I found out in doing some reading that around here the way they tapped maple trees is they took a bucket and set it below a tree and took an axe and took a whack out of the tree. Now, do that for 50 years and the trees are all gone. So I think that's why sugar maple is not here. But yeah, there are other species. And
are there other species other than trees?
Oh, yeah, no, that's a really important question. Can we go back to the very beginning? So here's what happened. The first settlers came in and they established their farms, cattle and sheep first. Go up, go to the bison. The first settlers came in and they moved the bison out. They left the trees behind. They moved their cattle and sheep, and they immediately started planting grasses. And there were no botanists here. You know, Andre Michaud came through the area until Thomas Jefferson kicked him out as a spy, which I guess he actually was. But so what happened? And this is a really interesting phenomenon. We don't know, except for giant cane. We do, and running buffalo clover. We do not know what the original ground vegetation was. So all we have to go on now is the trees
the cane, which has been reduced to a tiny fraction of what it used to be, and running buffalo clover, which is a federally endangered species. So I'm glad you asked that question. Yeah, we really don't know what the original vegetation was.
Have you attempted to use remote sensing devices, Google Earth or aerial photo lens, to locate individual trees?
We have attempted it and have failed. That is, from our aerial photographs, from Google Earth, from infrared photographs, we've not been able to identify the trees. The crowns do not look that different from other trees around the area. However, it's funny that you mentioned that. In the context of sciencing the shit out of this, I had a conference call last week with a group in this carbon sequestration program at NASA, and looks like we're going to get some help from them. They said, yeah, they can identify every tree we want to know. They use LIDAR, which is a laser, three-dimensional laser, which they can either do from space or from airplanes. Which, because one of the things we don't know how extensive these woodland pastures are. There's one woodland pasture in Woodford County, Kentucky, that covers about 12 square miles across multiple farms. But other than driving around or having people tell me where they are, that's the only way we've had to find them. So we do need to do something to do some remote sensing. The other remote sensing issue is that in order to study carbon sequestration, we have to figure out what's the volume of that tree. And that's extremely difficult to open ground trees. We know how to do it in forestry. It's extremely difficult to do. But three-dimensional lasers can do that. So that's something that we, you know, I hope in a couple of years I'd be able to say, yeah, we figured that out.
What about using some kind of spatial geometry analysis distance?
Well, we're already doing that. So when we survey a woodland pasture, we GPS all the trees. And we have been doing some pattern analysis without, we don't have quite enough data yet.
Over here? I have three big trees. I'm saying this because I can't have the brass.
Yes, good.
Big and old. And I was just wondering how old they are in downtown.
Yeah, let's talk about tree age. But first I want to talk about something else related to that, which is we really don't value our giant old trees enough. You know, and I'm talking about whether it's here or in the Blue Ridge. We're extremely risk averse. And I have to say, the tree care industry is not helping in this because a lot of arborists make a lot of money taking down trees. Okay, it's a lot easier for an arborist to say, yeah, that tree needs to come down because there's $2,000 in your pocket. We are insufficiently accepting of risk. There's a tree risk assessment method, which in my opinion is too conservative. You saw that tree with the kids running around it in the park. Okay, that tree's never going to hurt anybody. So I think we need to be more tolerant of big trees in our landscape. And especially after ice storms and things, people become scared of them. And I can understand that. But we need to change the culture in that respect. Now, the other question, part of the question is, what's the age of these trees? And as you see in the book, you cannot determine the age of a tree by looking at it, by its diameter. And the only way we have of doing this is by counting the annual rings. You know, as you all know, trees make on average a ring every year. So either you have to take a core, which is very labor intensive, or you have to take a tree down, which we try not to do. I have sort of a standing deal with all the arborists in Lexington that if they take a big tree down, call me and we'll get a cookie. We'll get a slab of wood, you know, a cross section of a tree. So I have one tree, there's one in the book that dates back to about 1750. But I have one tree that we got recently in Chicken Oak. It was hollow. All these trees are hollow. So you have to go to the first section you can get that's solid all over the pit. Okay? And so we got this Chinkton oak 14 feet off the ground, 1550. It was 14 feet tall in 1550. But for the most part, we will never know the age of most of these trees. Now, there are seven, and they're listed in the book, there's seven kind of guidelines to assessing whether a tree is ancient or not. I can look at two bur oaks, same size, and I can say, that one's not very old. That one's really old. But it's form and shape. We can't count the rings. That's a good question.
Questions? You said earlier you would tell us if we asked how you determine the dates or the droughts and whatnot.
Glad somebody was paying attention. Yeah. Well, how do you think we did? Name an organism that leaves a permanent record of its entire tree roots. Yeah. So what happened is there's this whole area of science called dendrochronology, telling time of trees. And at its simplest, we use it to count the rings and see how old the tree is. But you can also take two sets of cores from two different trees, and you can do what's called cross-dating. They have some good years and some bad years, and you can overlap them. And so now, because this is a huge area of science now, we have literally hundreds of thousands of cores from all over the world that have been dated and cross-dated. And we can extend those back. In the Southwest, we can extend tree age back about 20,000 years by finding dead wood and then correlating it with archaeological specimens and correlating living trees. Okay, so this is part of a big project from Lamont Doherty Earth Observatory at Columbia University that takes thousands of these cores and figures out, it's pretty obvious that tree growth is very sensitive to drought. And it's particularly sensitive to drought during the growing season. So the Palmer Drought Severity Index, is an indicator of summer moisture. Okay, so what you do is, now, you have to start during a period where you know the precipitation, because what you have to do is you have to correlate tree growth to Palmer Drought Index. And once you get a good correlation, you can then start going back in time. And we actually have these, for the United States, we actually have these going back BC in some parts of the country. But this is the best one for this region. I'm glad you asked that. That's how we do it. It's tree growth.
And why are you so... You said several times that there were no Native American communities.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, how is that they wouldn't live in such...
It's not that they didn't live in Kentucky. It's they didn't live in Blue Ridge. Okay. And it's bison. Okay, they could not compete with the bison. And I don't have a map, but there's one in the book. The only Shawnee settlement in... and by the way, that arrow point that we looked at, that was not a settlement. That was a hunting camp. Okay, the archaeologists could figure this out. The only Shawnee settlement in the Bluegrass was in Clark County, right on the edge where the outer Bluegrass becomes the Knobs. It's a 2,500-acre dead level ground. Shawnees were farmers. There were several farmers. Dead level ground, but surrounded on all sides by either fairly deep creeks or very steep slopes or both. And in addition, a quick getaway into the Knobs. I believe that this village, Skipakithiki, was the only place that the Shawnee could be safe from bison and fawn. And then they would go into the inner Bluegrass in the winter to hunt. And they didn't hunt bison because they didn't have the technology for it. Good question. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Maybe. You should be skeptical. I can't prove it.
Yes, sir. I've got one last. He asked about it's finding specimens, finding trees at the present time. Do you use, or have you used, any old methods, collections, for instance, scientific collections of area, or collections taken
for what?
For locating the older trees or specific species.
Well, they're still there.
Oh, yes.
I don't have to go to the herbarium.
Using those instead of going out and...
Well, no, because first of all, the botanical record is typically not spatially very accurate. And it's pretty sparse going back a ways, because there weren't a lot of botanists here. No, we need to find the trees and figure out how to do that remotely, as you said. Any other questions?
So are they going to find you these trees? How are they going to identify the trees?
Oh. NASA is able to do some amazing things. There is I can't remember the name of the project. There's an airplane-mounted platform that they can fly over a tropical rainforest. And keep in mind, the tropical rainforest has thousands of species. They can fly over a tropical rainforest, and the computer will identify every species, or almost every species.
So you look skeptical, and you should be. So what you need to do is go into remote sensing, go to graduate school, and find out how that works. Because I don't have a clue. I'm not a remote sensor.
They're using that to discover some of these Mayan ruins that were lost.
Oh, yeah, there's all kinds of things that they're finding, using remote sensing.
Well, on that note, I think it's time for our door prize. I want to thank Tom Kimberlin. Back, and I'm sure Tom will be happy to sign that for you at the end.
Before you leave,
how about 20 dozen lottery tickets?
I appreciate it if you would sign up here. We promise not to send you any spam or inundate your inbox, but we'll keep you apprised of events and things. We're doing a lot more in Nashville, which is not far away.
And we're going to give away, Brian will model list, some of our new white squirrel t-shirts. I'll get you to pick one for us. On behalf of our sponsor, WKU Libraries, a little token of our appreciation.
Well, thank you so much. Thank you.
And we'll be setting up, if you'd like to get a copy of the book, we'll be signing them over here. Thank you again, and have a good evening.
Thank you.